I think we're going to go ahead and get started. I'd like to welcome you to the Women on Wednesday, still fighting for our rights 30 years later. My name is Marie Fisher, and I'd just like to go over a few housekeeping items before we get started. Please turn off all cell phones and pagers and stay in your seats until 12:50. If you could please fill out the evaluation sheet, as we do use this information for future programming. Also, please stop by the back table for information on scholarships for women, as the deadline is soon approaching. Our session today is entitled, Is There a Safety Net? Women, Welfare, and Poverty. Poverty is a major barrier to equality for women. Millions of women who depend on income transfer programs or low-paying jobs for their basic life support may be subject to the multiple oppressions of sexism, racism, and poverty, states the National Plan of Action 30 years ago. How is it different for poor women today as compared to 30 years ago? Further, does it continue to be the case that many women are only one paycheck away from poverty and the need for income or food assistance, as well as publicly paid health insurance? Using the lens of race, class, and gender, our presenter will provide data and perspective on issues of women, welfare, and poverty. Barti Wahi is currently the Director of Programs and Membership at the Minnesota Women's Consortium. The daughter of immigrant parents, Wahi grew up in southern Minnesota and graduated from the College of St. Catherine with her BA in History and Women's Studies. Wahi also holds a graduate degree in public policy and nonprofit management from the University of Chicago. She has worked in the nonprofit community for the past 12 years in the areas of domestic violence and welfare, HIV/AIDS policy, education, and the women's movement. We are very grateful to have her with us today. Please join the Women's Center in welcoming Barti Wahi. Sorry.
Hi, everybody. I want to thank the Women's Center for inviting me here today. It's an honor to have an opportunity to talk to so many people, and I really am hoping that it'll be worth your time because it's so nice outside. As I was coming here, I just thought, God, if I were them, I'd want to be outside and not listening to me. So I hope I make it worth your while to be here today. As Marie said, my name is Barti Wahi. I work at the Minnesota Women's Consortium, and let me get a little bit of that housekeeping done. The Minnesota Women's Consortium is a consortium of approximately 160 different women's organizations around the state, all working in some way, shape, or form on women's equality and justice for all women and girls in the state of Minnesota. And we do that, our mission, is through helping connect those organizations to each other, but also then to connect those organizations and that community to the larger community. I was surprised when they asked me to talk about welfare because I haven't done specific work in welfare in a really long time, but it was the thing that I studied in college, and it is really the thing that informed my work experience for probably the first, 9 years of my professional life, and it has had an enormous impact on the way I view policy in this country and how and sort of my hope or future vision for the future. So I'm very honored to have gotten the opportunity to talk to you all today. So, is there a safety net? Well, I don't know. I'm not sure anymore. And, I'm not sure if there is, but I'll let you guys maybe be more the judge than I. I'll just present information. Okay, so when I was thinking about having to come and talk for 40 minutes, I thought, gee, either that's going to seem like a really long time to talk to you all, or it's going to seem really short. Because frankly, poverty, welfare, and sort of some of the structural underpinnings that create that issue could really be like a whole semester class. So either I'm going to give you way too much information or way too little. So again, I'll let you be the judge. So helping the poor. In the U.S., we have a history of providing help to the poor. And a common way that throughout history, whether it is in the 1800s or now, we think about the poor and the way we're going to help them is the poor tends to be divided into two categories, those who are deserving of our help and those who are not. And it's usually how we define the problem of poverty that really informs who is deserving and who isn't. Is it about individuals' bad behaviors that causes poverty, or might there be other structural underpinnings that cause poverty? And depending upon how you view that, you sort of get who gets help and who doesn't. I'm going to promise to not read to you because nothing irritated me more in school than people just sat up here and read what they wrote. So, there are always some, no matter what kind of policy you work, you do in this country, there's always some assumptions that sort of inform how we view the problem or how we view the solution that we're going to, you know, utilize to address the problem. So I wanted to get you all talking because I don't want to be up here talking about you for 40 minutes. But what assumptions do you think people have around poverty, around welfare, and those who receive help? Anybody? I'm throwing it out. Yes, laziness. That would be certainly be one. Other assumptions. Come on. Well, yeah, that people have children because they want to make an extra $200 a month. That's right. I think other assumptions that people have about poverty is that it really is about individual behavior. That if somehow we can change individuals' behaviors, it might. We might be able to eliminate poverty. I think other assumptions that people have about poverty or welfare programs is that they're to help people get out of poverty. I don't know that that's a realistic. I don't know that that's what it really does. But I think people think we're providing welfare and people will get out of poverty. I don't know that that's really the case. Or that's even really the point of it. It might be something else, like maybe to regulate the poor. Any other assumptions that you can think people have about poverty, people on it, welfare? Yes. Yep. That the poor aren't smart enough to know how to use their money. That's very smart. That's a really good one. Anybody else? Oh, come on. Don't make me do all the talking. All right. I'll let you relax. Okay, now how do you think those assumptions sort of feed into public policy? People who make policy are just like you and me, and they are operating with a whole sort of set of beliefs, half ideas, you know, half truths, whatever, real facts. I mean, so how do you think these assumptions sort of weigh in? Yes, thank you. Yep, I think that's definitely it. I think that people's assumptions about poverty and about what makes people poor also really inform the kind of ways government is going to intervene in their lives. If we think that people aren't smart, poor people aren't smart enough to spend their money wisely, we're going to intervene, you know, to make sure that they are. So those kinds of assumptions have an impact on how people, the public policy options we choose. And always remember, public policy options are things we choose. They're not set in stone. Okay, over the course of my study, it sort of really started to occur to me, here, I got to move this, that I think there are essentially three ways that people view what causes poverty in this country. I think, again, as we said, there is individual causal models. So people assume that it is about individual bad behavior or some kind of individual behavior around birth, around spending, around attitudes towards work that cause poverty. There are also structural. The next one would be structural, and that sort of moves it out. So it's not necessarily about individuals, but sort of what institutions and systems might be in place that keep people in poverty or cause poverty. So things like racism, sexism, gender bias, some of the ways that our education system might be structured, things might be causes of poverty. And if you're to alleviate poverty, right, if you're to create solutions, you have to think about what the cause would be. And looking at structural ones, those policy changes might be around some of those issues like addressing discrimination. And then there's some combination of the two. And I would argue that probably poverty is a really complex sort of dynamic kind of thing. It's ever sort of moving and changing. And I would argue that, you know, societal impacts has an impact on individual behavior, and then those sort of have impact on societal, you know, sort of structures, and so it just kind of keeps going that way. And I want you to keep kind of those three sort of causal models in mind as we're sort of looking at poverty as we define it now, sort of the history of it, to sort of see where you think policy solutions have sort of tended to lie. So, okay, poverty in the U.S. and Minnesota. I am the queen of the facts. I just think they're really fun, so I have a lot of facts for you and sources so that if you happen to think you might use those sometime later, there you go. I happen to be at a public policy hearing. Currently, the state has a commission that is been put together to end poverty in Minnesota by 2020, which is a really ambitious feat, given it was only the commission was only funded for like a year. Well, we'll see. But as I was sitting in this meeting, there was an economic definition that was given to sort of define who the poor are. And it was given by the state economist and demographer. And I thought it was a good, although albeit incomplete, definition of who the poor are. It is a nice economic sort of definition that I think it's easy for people to get their minds around. And essentially, and I'm sorry, I will read this to you. The poor are those who are unable to purchase a minimum adequate market basket of goods and services. Essentially, it's economic deprivation from a very economic standpoint of view. Now, many would argue, and I think they would correctly argue, that the poor and also, there's a whole sort of social and political definition of who is in poverty that isn't captured by this definition, but it is a good starting place because there are certainly stigmas and a whole status. If you economic, you know, status with sort of the social and political implications if you are poor. Okay, so here's a little bit of the policy sort of wonkiness, and you'll have to forgive me, but in this country, we have sort of two major measures of poverty. One of those measures is the poverty threshold, and that's the one that's used primarily by the census for statistical information. And it's calculated, they have a whole sort of table of different thresholds depending upon the size of your family and the sort of makeup of it. That determines where one is, if they live in poverty or not. And really, if a family's total income is less than the family's threshold, the family and then every subsequent individual in that family is considered living below poverty. Then there are also poverty guidelines. And these guidelines are actually what are used by programs like welfare or child care assistance or Minnesota Care that are used to determine who is eligible for these kinds of services. And they're calculated an entirely different way. So when you hear somebody talking about poverty, try to understand maybe from which perspective they are. If you're hearing about people, whether they're eligible for a program or not, they're using poverty guidelines. And those numbers are different. Okay, so poverty thresholds. Just very quickly, again, they're a dollar amount used to determine poverty status. The calculation is the same across the country. There are no regional variations in terms of how they do this. This calculation is used not only to determine who's in poverty, but also the sort of demographic breakdown, female-headed households, race and ethnicity, that kind of thing. And, for example, and I wanted to give you a real number, the threshold for a family of three with two children under the ages of 18 is $16,242. So that means if you make $16,243, you are not in poverty. Okay? All right. Okay, here's the poverty guidelines. Again, this is sort of calculated by the Department of Health and Human Services. It varies by region. Alaska and Hawaii are calculated differently, and I have no idea why. Maybe somebody here in the crowd knows better than I do, but I just can't figure out why, but they are. So, for example, according to the 2008 Health and Human Services guidelines, a family of three living in the continental United States is considered below poverty if they make $17,600. So this number is, in fact, higher than the way the Census Bureau would calculate it, which is actually sort of a good thing because that means more people will be able to utilize services. So the person who makes $16,243 will still be eligible for Social Security, maybe SSI, however, whatever program they're trying to get. So, who lives in poverty? This is sort of a little bit of a snapshot of the nation. And all of this data was collected by the current population survey. It's a survey that U.S. Census Bureau uses, you know, periodically. In 2010, obviously, they're going to be doing the major census, and so they're going to have more information, and that data sort of more captures a bigger sample and stuff. But this is sort of the current U.S. Census Bureau's information. So currently, in the entire country, 12.3% of the population lives at or below poverty level. The percentage of female-headed households with no husband at living at poverty level is 28.3. So of all the female-headed households, 28% live in or below poverty. Obviously, it is families that have children that might have the greater vulnerability to living in poverty. And as you can see, 16% and 20% of those, children under 18 and then children under 6. And then they have some statistics by race. So as you can see, 10% of white people here in the country live at or below poverty level. For African Americans, that's 24% of African Americans do. Asians are 10% and Hispanic. And the Census Bureau calculates Hispanics a little bit differently, so sometimes that information can be confusing. So, now, what does it look like here in the state of Minnesota? According to the state demographer's office, the state's poverty rate is at 9.2%, which is better than the national average. However, poverty rates for African Americans and Native American people here in the state is actually higher and significantly higher than the national average. The percentage of female-headed households in the state with no husband living on the home, who are living below poverty is 30%. So again, a little bit, the numbers are a little bit worse. Oh, and just super quick, this information was determined by the American Community Survey. And that's another survey that you can, the Census Bureau uses that looks at information by state. And this is just a really, the demographer came up with this information using that survey, and I just absolutely love this table. But I think people who, we understand people and poverty, I think we just think people who have welfare are on poverty, you know, live in poverty. But that is, in fact, not true. Sources of income for Minnesotans below poverty, if you'll see, and I hope it's sort of clear, 55% comes from wage and salary income. So people, we have working poor. You know, it's not about government aid, but really people who work are really struggling. So what do we do about that? So historically, what has been our response to welfare or to poverty? And I think many would say it would be helping the poor, sort of. Okay, so the history of the safety net. And you have to go back about 200 years in terms of understanding sort of the U.S. sort of response to aid. But during the 1800s, aid was really the job of local units of government, so city, county, that kind of thing. There was no federal system involved at that point. At that time, and I think I would argue certainly now, the poor were looked upon as somehow morally lacking, and aid tended to be punitive. And I think that those are themes that you will see, although maybe not as overtly as back in the day, run through our system even today. Aid consisted primarily of the work that churches did, things like the poorhouse, the workhouse, orphanages. Sometimes aid came in the form of food that was given by a church community to a poor family. Aid was primarily for whites. People of color were not eligible. I mean, let's really be clear about that. Aid was really just for whites. And because they were considered the deserving ones. Always sort of be mindful of that sort of distinction. And women who had to apply for aid tended to really take the brunt of sort of the society's distaste for giving out relief. Because if you had to work or if you were seen having to go to the poorhouse to work or the workhouse, you were seen as a neglectful parent, and you were also morally bankrupt because clearly, you know, there was something sort of wrong about you that made you be poor. At the start of the 20th century, mothers' pensions programs started to sort of rise, and you see the state starting to become involved in welfare, so moving one step out for government. And these programs were primarily for children of fatherless children, and really they had to be widowed white women who got services. If you were divorced, if the father left, if you were a woman of color, these services were not for you. Again, you were not considered deserving. But widowed people, yeah, you know, that sort of, you know, somebody died. They were a much more palatable group to give money to. The elderly also made up one of the biggest portions of those who lived in poverty because it was harder for that group to work. And the prevailing attitude was either you should have saved up or you should have family that supports you. And for women, this was a particular disadvantage, this particular attitude, in that women's jobs did not really offer very good wages in terms of saving. I mean, most women's work was not unpaid. And so what were you supposed to do when you were in your later years? So that brings us to the Depression. And the New Deal. Okay, so for those who don't know, there was a stock market crash in 1929. The Great Depression happened. Prior to the Depression, about 18 million women, children, elderly, disabled people in this country were living at a bare subsistence level. By 1933, you had an additional 13 million people who were now no longer working. And this created, I think, one of the most significant sort of revolutions around welfare and aid that the country has seen before or since. Because what happened is you no longer have aid and welfare being about poor folks, but now it's also about people who were middle class, who had farms, those kinds of things. And so suddenly government is starting to take helping people much more seriously, because it's not just about, you know, poor, disabled, elderly, children, women, whatever, but now it is about a much larger pool, and they have to act. So you have the passage of the 1935 Social Security Act by FDR, and this was set up the federal retirement program, so the benefits we all get when we turn 65. You also get unemployment insurance, and this was a way to sort of help people who became unemployed maybe get more money, you know, tied them over till they got jobs. It also established for the first time a federal welfare system, which would essentially, for the most part, stay in place for another 61 years after this. And the feds finally decided to pony up and give the states money, help with a third of the money they were spending on aid to children, not women or individuals, but families that had dependent children. And that is the start of the aid to families with dependent children, AFDC. Okay, so that system exists until about the 1960s. And it is during this time when you have some of the great civil movements, like the Civil Rights Movement, the Women's Movement, that you get Lyndon Johnson's administration's War on Poverty. And again, I think this was also another one of the government's responses to public outcry about who was able to access services and who weren't. You also see some enormous programs that are still incredibly important to our welfare system in this country begin, including Medicaid and food stamps. During this time, you see groups who had historically never really been able to access welfare or programs being able to through the work of the civil rights movement. So you see a lot of communities of color finally being able to access services that for a long time had been denied to them, because the states still had primary control. So in places like the South, and many would argue in the North, in northern urban areas, they are finally able to access services that had been denied a really long time. And in 1974, you see Congress passes the Supplemental Securities Act, which some people might know as disability, which helped disabled folks, but primarily disabled children. Okay, so now these systems are in place, and now, if you will, the pendulum swings the other way. And in the 80s, you start to see a rise in sort of the backlash around poverty. During that time, President Reagan was in office, and there had been some economic downturn. And he started to talk a lot about sort of the welfare queen. At that time, you see a lot of people talking about, women, primarily women of color, are sitting back, just getting a lot of money, they're driving in Cadillacs. And that stereotype really fed to sort of historical ideas that we had about the poor being lazy and not deserving of aid. And it really became a very sort of entrenched stereotype in the media and in the public discourse. And with policymakers. And you start to see a push for welfare reform. And some of those reform ideas were not bad ideas. Some were a response to like, oh yeah, people are taking advantage of the system. But others were really about maybe that the system isn't really about helping people get out of poverty, but maybe about keeping them there and how do we change it. And others thought, you know, AFDC, although having its problems, was still a pretty good safety net for vulnerable people. And that brings us to the 90s. And I call this slide sort of ending welfare as we know it. And it's a phrase that President Clinton, and that would have been Bill at the time, coined. He was going to reform welfare. And I think when he originally made that statement, I think he had some really thoughtful ideas about why are people in poverty? What are the things that keep low-wage work from really helping people move out? So they started to have conversations about, like, yeah, we can throw cash. You know, you can throw $400 a month at somebody, but is that really going to get at poverty? I mean, it's sort of like using, like, a garden hose on an inferno. So if cash hasn't been working for all of these years, what else do we need to do? And conversations around housing assistance, health care, education, child care started to come to the fore. However, by 1994, we had a sort of Republican Congress that had different ideas about how it wanted to reform welfare. And it sort of took a life on its own. So many of those sort of programs that might have really helped people in low-wage work and really helped make it useful to get welfare, to get off of welfare, didn't quite end up happening in the way they would. And in 1996, Clinton signed the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunities Act. And this essentially ended 61 years of AFDC. So this One New Deal program was no longer in place. And it created in its place the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, the TANF program, which is funded by federal and state money, where state governments have an enormous amount of discretion about how they will administer welfare. But there are a couple of key sort of federal guidelines that states have to follow. And those guidelines are there is a two-year consecutive, sort of 24-month consecutive time limit between the time of receiving cash and the time you need to be at work. And there is now also a five-year lifetime. So over the course of my life, I can only be on it for 60 months. States now have to demonstrate that they are moving people to work instead of sort of just keeping them, I guess, on the rolls. And if they don't, they're going to be penalized. They will. I think there was a 5% cut in your TANF block grant from the feds. Congress reduced welfare benefits sort of across the board, and then they also really tightened up eligibility to other programs that had started during the 1960s. So eligibility for SSI, for disabled children, really, really, really got narrow, and it's a lot harder to get now if you have a disability. And then food stamps, cash welfare, Medicaid benefits, and SSI were eliminated for most legal immigrants. If you are here as a refugee or if your immigration status is a refugee, there is some leeway. But for the most part, you're out of luck. So what was Minnesota's response at this time? Well, Minnesota did two things that were very different. Minnesota decided, yeah, we'll take the TANF money, but we're going to create our own program. And what they did was they created the Minnesota Family Investment Program, MFIP. And at that time, instead of sort of all of the work requirements, because with TANF, in order to receive that, you need to be either working some hours or have some kind of job training. Well, Minnesota decided to put a greater emphasis on job training and education. That if people really are going to get out of poverty, there's a lot of empirical data that says the better the education, the less likely they're going to be in poverty. So that's what they decided to do. That's where they decided to put their emphasis. And they were able to do that because there was state leeway. They also, at this time, during the mid-90s, created Minnesota Care, which, is sometimes a hard, cumbersome system. But I think one of the great geniuses of the state of Minnesota, because they really decided, you know, low-wage work doesn't offer benefits, so what are we going to do for those folks? And they came up with an idea, and although it's not a complete, you know, solution to the problem, it's maybe a step in the right direction. And then, okay, so that brings us to today, the 2000s, or whatever we're calling it. And in 2006, the Deficit Reduction Act required human services to really tighten up what those work requirements are. So now, if you receive welfare, there aren't really any job training options for you. You just really have to get to work. And they really don't care what kind of work it is, but you just have to work. So it tends to really be low-wage work, and that's the direction that people are pushed. On the state level, Minnesota might have started real good in that sort of mid-90s kind of time frame. But because of some of the economic downturns, really, programs have been cut, eligibility around child care, Minnesota care have been narrowed. If you receive welfare benefits and you also have a disabled child in your family and receive some SSI, your welfare benefit was cut. If you receive housing subsidies, sometimes called Section 8, your benefit was cut as well, because clearly we don't want you to have too much money. So, is there a safety net? Well, I would think that some people call MFIP now MFIP Lite, because what was maybe a really good program has now really sort of very much matching sort of some of the other models that the other states are using. And so, yeah, I think people would say that it's slowly but steadily eroding. And the work requirements increase, opportunities for education and job training are sort of being depleted. And people are not going to get out of poverty if they are stuck in minimum wage jobs. It's just not going to happen for a family of four or three. So we talked in the beginning of our sort of discussion, what are some of the assumptions that people have about welfare? One was that people were on welfare forever, but that's not really true. People move in and out of welfare. Welfare is essentially a system that helps people during periods of economic downturn, periods of unemployment, you know, perhaps a new birth in the family, that kind of thing. So the average is between 9 and 18 months. Even before the time limits existed, people were on AFDC approximately this much. Because honestly, if you are, even with AFDC, to engage in the government when you engage in welfare also allows for very little privacy in your life. So you really have to need this in order to get it, because there aren't many people who would subject themselves to this kind of sort of humiliation and lack of privacy unless they really had to. There's an idea that whites don't utilize MFIP or TANF, that this is really, welfare is really about communities of color. And although they might be disproportionately representative, whites in the state of Minnesota actually are the largest number of utilizers of MFIP in the state at 39%. And then there's some idea that most people who are on MFIP are uneducated, and that is actually false. And I think especially given we are in a time of rising tuition costs, as I'm sure you all well know, 48% of the people on MFIP have college educations. So, you know, high school education. So college is a key component to how one might not end up in this place. And if it continues to become more and more expensive, you're going to see a lot more people in much more economically vulnerable positions. So, women, welfare, and poverty. As I said before, women make up a disproportionate number of single-headed female households or single-headed households that live below poverty, 30% in Minnesota. And what that has meant is all kinds of really sort of very sort of gender-specific, maybe gender-biased, you know, solutions to what that might mean. And one of them that has been really pushed in this last decade, certainly by the Bush administration, is to really encourage marriage. The idea that if poor single women are a burden on the rolls, let's get them married. Let's encourage marriage in order to alleviate that. And that might be a way women can get out of poverty if they married. Now, this only applies for heterosexual couples. Now, if you are a gay couple or if you are a lesbian or a gay man and you have children, well, marriage isn't an option for you. So that just to be clear that they're also sort of very heterosexist. Policies limiting the number of children welfare recipients are already in place. There is a thing called a family cap in the state of Minnesota. So if you happen to be on welfare and if you happen to have another child, you can't get cash aid for that child. There are other assistance you might be able to get, but you will not be able to get in MFIP welfare cash benefit. And while these caps are in place, we have subsequently decreased the amount of money that's available for family planning, so things like contraception, for people who are uninsured, programs that would help give money to help provide money so that people can get their birth control or good family planning information. And also, we struggle with getting comprehensive sex ed to be a part of our sort of discourse in the classroom. So, and for women in poverty, the pay gap for white women is still 73 cents for every dollar that a man makes. That is a national statistic. That is a state statistic. For women of color, that number drops even further. And these are the numbers that you never hear about. I mean, I think you hear 73 cents, and they think it's all women, but that is, in fact, just white women. If you are an African-American woman, if you're an Asian woman, if you're a Latina, that number drops from 65 cents to every dollar that a white man makes to 53 cents. So if we are talking about low-wage work and what that means for women, women of color, this is what that means. That means that you're going to make half as much as a man who is in that same position. So these are important things to consider. There's also an overrepresentation of women in low-wage work, and that has a little bit to do with sort of the way job segregation has happened, but it is also a contributing factor to why women's poverty rates are still so much greater than men's. And, I mean, that is really about gender bias. That is the structural underpinning of poverty that really gets so little address in terms of our own programs. So when we had originally started our conversation, we had talked about causal models. And I think it is sort of easier to see that most of the models, most of our welfare programs really lean towards modifying individual behavior or their individual attitudes around work. And really don't get to the sort of some of the structural underpinnings that exist around poverty. Things like sexism, racism, economic oppression, homophobia, these are just never addressed in welfare programs. I mean, maybe somebody's talking about them sort of in individual case management, but they are not a part of how we look at welfare. Welfare programs do not sort of address sort of the complexity of the interplay of variables. So, you know, if I don't have health care, if child care is a struggle for me, how do I work 30 hours a week to get my MFIT benefit? These are some of the really key questions. And as we move to sort of MFIP light or whatever people are calling it, government is less and less concerned about the interplay of those dynamics. They're just really primarily concerned with moving people on to work. So, areas of further study. Like, you could go on forever and study these particular issues, but in terms of what you all might be interested in or where directions it might lead you, really looking at what is the purpose of welfare. I mean, I would argue that the purpose of welfare is really just about modifying individual behavior. I don't even know that it's really about moving people out of poverty. I think it's also really a tool for regulation, whether it was back in the day when we had really punitive welfare practices in order to keep people from asking for help, like the poorhouse or the workhouse, to the government's response to, like, suddenly this enormous group of unemployed people during the Depression. It might be a tool of regulation. And there's a really great book by two individuals, Francis Piven and Richard Cloward, called Regulating the Poor, The Function of Public Welfare. And I think it makes a really strong argument that welfare might not really be about poverty, but really about regulating the poor and managing them. What would solutions look like for the structural underpinnings of poverty? Who knows? I mean, in a time when affirmative action and subjects around quotas are really a lot more difficult to talk about sort of in the public level. How do we address some of those systemic things? And maybe to even be like more crazy, like what would redistributive income measures be like? Like the earned income tax credit, where you really have poor people getting a cash benefit that is really being redistributed from the top down. I mean, those are all options. And the welfare policies that we have are options we choose to have. I mean, it's not set in stone. Nobody says we have to do these things this way. It's just what we do. And we don't have to if we start to be creative. Okay, so what can you do? All right, I had this handout, and I'm not really sure if you all got it or whatever. But I didn't want to leave you with this really depressing sort of like, okay, welfare is terrible. It sucks. Like, the system is so jacked up. Okay, let's all go home. I didn't want to do that to you. So what I did do is I put together this sheet of paper of organizations that are working on the issues of poverty and welfare in this country, in the state of Minnesota. And there's some really great organizations on there that are doing really incredible work. Poverty and welfare stuff is not particularly, I don't know, sexy in the sort of public realm. Like, people don't want to talk about poor people generally. And these are organizations and advocates that are doing a great job at that. And then there's opportunities to learn more. I mean, I have a bibliography that you could certainly or welcome to have or share or whatever. But I also, we have an intern, and I have to put in a plug for her at my organization. Her name is Allison McWilliams Brooks, and she has just created this an incredible piece of scholarship around poverty, heterosexism, and women of color, and sort of the connection and the byplay between like options like marriage, like when a whole group can't be married because there are sort of legal constraints about that. And it's just an amazing piece of work. And she is more than happy to tell people about it. And I just wanted to plug because it's so great. I wish she could have come here to talk to you and not me. Okay, so there's my bibliography. And then, so if you're interested, here you go. You can come up here and look at it if you want. And then questions. Yes. For, hold on. Let me look. For education and job training, which? She was wondering where I got the statistics for the education and job training. The education and job training. Which slide was it? There? Oh, those are part of the discourse that was a part of, so I got that from looking at testimony at the time of the creation of MFIP. This one right here? The family investment? Oh, just the state's website. They have a whole history on the history of MFIP. And I will say, like, if you go to the state's website, they're going to be like, yay, MFIP is great, da-da-da-da-da, you know. So there might be others who might provide a kind of a, you know, maybe a broader analysis. But you can just go to the state's website and get that information. Any other questions? Yes? Sure. It is called Regulating the Poor, the Functions of Public Welfare, and it's by Francis Fox Piven and Richard Cloward. It's a great book. Any other questions? Yes. You know, people... There's no evidence that if one state offers a better welfare benefit than another, you know, state. I mean, there may be a few people, but there's no evidence that that is happening in mass numbers. And I think that's also sort of part of the sort of stereotypes that sort of kind of took hold in the 80s, that like people were coming and in Minnesota, oh my God, we're being attacked by all these poor folks of color who are coming from other states to get our benefit. But there's really no evidence because, I mean, welfare benefit is so small. I mean, you would have to uproot your family. You would probably have to uproot, you know, people, you know, your extended support system. So, I mean, unless they're offering you like a gold bathroom, a lot of people were not going to do that. I mean, the cost of moving, you know, alone. So it was just, there's just no evidence of that. And you hear that over and over again. There's just no evidence that one state offering a better system than others. So I would argue no. I mean, might there be a couple of people who think they might can get a better gig here, but I don't think they move in droves. Anybody else? Yes.
Because they have college degrees.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, when people can get out of poverty, I mean, the whole... I mean, I think there's the attitude that the rising tide floats all ships. I mean, I think if everybody moves up and out, people tend to do better. You know, society tends to do better. And, but I don't know that that was a consideration. I mean, I don't know, again, I don't know that, they might have changed welfare as we knew it, but I don't think they essentially, like, were that concerned about people in poverty and economic sort of justice. Any other questions? Well, thanks for listening. It was a nice day out. I appreciate you listening to me. Good luck with school, everybody.